and a warm welcome to tonight's conversation between artist Lisa Tan and Håkan Fischer, professor in human biological psychology here at Stockholm University. My name is Therese Kjellner. I work as curator here at Accelerator. Thank you so much, Håkan and Lisa, for being here and for sharing some insights in your respective work. I'm so excited to hear both of you expand on common interest here tonight. I will just say a few quick notes before I leave the floor to Lisa and Håkan. This is an event that is organized in relation to Lisa Tan's ongoing exhibition here at Accelerator that is on until February 11th next year, and that is open tonight until 8 o'clock, so you have the chance to see this exhibition after tonight's conversation. It's also a conversation that is organized as part of Accelerator's art and research program. So at the heart of what we do here at Accelerator is to try to foster a dialogue between artists and researchers in relation to the exhibition processes that we're working on. So when we're making an exhibition with an artist, we're always suggesting, asking whether that artist would like to talk to one of the very many experts that we have here at the university around us here. This conversation is being recorded. It's good to know. We will, Lisa and Håkan will talk for about 45 minutes maybe, and then leave some room at the end for questions. So you'll have the chance to ask them then, and please wait for a microphone when you ask your question, so that question can be recorded. All right, so yeah, I will just leave you two with a first question to start off this conversation. And I would like both of you, if you could start by introducing us to your work. And I think I will give this microphone to Håkan to start with, because I know personally Lisa's work really well. And I'm really curious to hear you, Håkan, talk about your work. So perhaps you could just start by explaining what the difference is between a human biological psychologist and a neurologist. Thank you.
So thank you, and I'm really excited to be here and to be able to talk about this topic, but also talk with Lisa here about the exhibition and everything around that. My name is Håkan Fischer. I'm a brain scientist. I'm working here at Stockholm University. I've been trying to understand the brain and how it works in relation to how we feel emotions and how we think and make decisions and so on. And I've been doing that for the past 30 years or so. Time flies. Feels like I started yesterday. So what I do and we do is that we put people in brain scanners, and while they're doing different types of tasks, we are also looking at their brain function, and then we try to link what they are doing with what is happening in the brain to get like two levels of analysis to really be able to pinpoint down what is consciousness, what is fear, what is love, what is whatever, right? So this is really at the heart of what I'm doing. And I'm not doing this, of course, alone. I'm doing this with my group. And in the world now, we are thousands and thousands of scientists trying to understand what is happening in our inner space, which is far more complicated than the outer space, I would say.
Therese, where'd she go? Did Håkan answer your question about what the difference is between a human biological psychologist and a neuroscientist or a neurologist?
No, true. Thank you. No, I didn't. I was so. I would say that the difference is the viewpoint. So a neurologist is sort of looking at the brain as a functional machine in a way. It looks, he or she looks at the brain, you know, from a functional standpoint, what is working and why it's working and how it's working. Whereas I, then coming from psychology, I'm looking more from the outside in a way. I have questions that are sort of psychological or philosophical in that standpoint, and then I try to understand them by looking at the brain. So it's a matter of viewpoint, really, if you are looking at the brain sort of from the inside or from the outside.
Okay. Thank you. So hi, everybody. My name is Lisa Tan, and I do hope you see the exhibition after the talk if you haven't already, or maybe you want to visit it again. This is a view of downstairs. It's kind of funny, just showing it. It's just right down there. I just have a point of reference. I'm just going to tell you very, very, very briefly about how I started thinking about this exhibition when Therese came over to my studio along with Richard Julien, the artistic director of Accelerator, and invited me to be part of this, to have this exhibition, the solo exhibition, and occupy the two spaces, the two galleries of Accelerator. I immediately thought about this drawing by the neurologist Oliver Sacks that I had seen many, many years ago, and I guess it lodged itself in my memory. You can tell me how that works later, but it lodged itself in my memory and tapped me on the shoulder when I was given the prompt to do something with this gallery. If you'll notice on the lower, I'm also dyslexic, the lower left-hand side of the graph, it's actually a graph or a diagram, but I'm inclined to call it a drawing or a floor plan or a map, you'll see this very narrow rectangle. Spasmodic group, spasmodic asthma, croup, and angina. That section right there. And it reminded me very much of this particular architectural feature in one of the galleries of Accelerator in this room that has the oak wood floors. It's a very distinctive room because it's very different from the concrete room, which is to the right of it. The concrete room is cold because it's concrete floors. And then, can you hear me okay, by the way? That's good, okay. And it has very high ceilings. And then if you're going through the passage between these spaces, you enter into the floor, the room with the oak wood floors, which is warmer because of the oak wood, and the ceiling drops significantly, and then it rises up again. And so you have these very distinctive features along with this very elegant ramp that goes up on the wood side. And you'll see that if you visit the galleries downstairs afterwards. But my hunch was to put this drawing directly on top of the exhibition spaces as an organizing principle for the entire exhibition. Where I'm thinking about consciousness, it's been a long-standing interest of mine, is how subjectivity is formed, how it can change, how it's contingent, what we recall, what comes along that is completely unexpected and produces desire, and how this all goes towards forming a sense of self. So the fact that Oliver Sacks, who's a British neurologist who worked mostly in the States, and as a young neurologist, he was studying migraine, curious about it because it's largely uncategorizable. I mean, it has so many different afflictions that can visit a sufferer of migraine. And so he sat with his patients and would listen to them. And he was a really great, great empath, which I think, but you could tell me what you think, made him a really good researcher.
Yeah, no, Oliver Sacks was really, really a pioneer in this field. He was a neurologist, but he had very many, in my viewpoint, psychological questions, right? So this really made him unique. And what he also did, which I find is very important, is that he studied individuals, right? He looked at individuals and how individuals experienced whatever, migraine, or he had very many different topics that he studied. And he then realized that even though there are common themes among a group of patients with migraine, as for example, there are also unique patterns that need to be considered because otherwise the image is incomplete. So he sort of thought that the mean of all these experiences do not really show any of these patients' condition, because the mean is just an abstraction, right? No one is the mean. So in that sense,
And the mean, you mean the average, right?
Exactly. The average. So the average is an abstraction, and that is, in that sense, not really of interest, right? Of interest is the variation between people, but also within people across time. So I think that what is in positivistic science being regarded as noise, that's variance, that's noise, you should sort of try to control for that. But to me, Sachs and all these other brilliant researchers that are really using this focus on individuals, they consider this as the foci of what should be researched on. So I think that's, you know, he's very pioneering also in that sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I just gravitated towards this because I love it, this, again, I call it a drawing with these, it's hand drawn also, I guess a product of its time as well, but these little stipples for where the migraine and the aura is. And that's what I followed up in the space below with the carpet, which is this hand painted dots. So what I was thinking, and if for those of you who have seen the exhibition and those of you who haven't, there are these zones, well, for those of you who haven't, there are these zones that are created by this simple gesture of putting one space on top of another space and the gaps that happen in between, and also moving through these open walls. Right, which is an oxymoron, but open walls. And in these zones, there are different individual autonomous works, but within the context of this installation, they work together as a totality. But to feel that, or to sense that totality, and Hawk and we were talking about it before in the conference room before, which also ran the risk of, you know, that thing when two people are supposed to be in a conversation and you're supposed to be hearing it, but we end up having the really interesting conversation that we're now going to try to replicate for you in this room. But we were talking about the brain. You were telling me how the brain doesn't like ambiguity, right? And that because it doesn't like ambiguity, but every single moment of our lives is so filled, every split second, every microsecond is ambiguous until we give it meaning. And when we give it meaning, or when we understand something, that is through an interpretive process of locating signs or signs that we know and making sense of where we are in order to breathe and walk and function in our daily lives. And this is what creates meaning. So bridging this gap that's constantly a matter of an experience, our brain's experience of ambiguity, is what I was trying to do with the exhibition, is that there is an ambiguity there. The letters are freestanding. You will try, I think, or that was my speculation, to try to make meaning, to try to make a word, because we are linguistic beings. We will try to make a word. I was channeling the feeling of being in an airport in the concrete space, when you've had an early flight or you're sick or you're jet lagged and you just want a coffee or you just need to figure out where your gate is. Maybe you're in a foreign country. And, you know, there's something that you know about this space because you've been in airports before, but maybe there are different languages or different signs and you constantly have to try to make meaning. So that was the first space. So, I don't know if you have something to say about that, the way the brain works and the way then it produces subjectivity.
Yeah, no, that's true. So the brain don't like ambiguity because the brain needs to understand the world around us. But the world around us is, so even though the world around us is objective, our experience of this world in the brain is very subjective, more subjective than we ever think it is, because we think that we have same experience of the reality regardless of who we are, you know, that Lisa and I see you as, you know, in the same way and you see us in the same way. But that's not how it is, because the brain just get in, I would say like 1% of all the sensory information comes into the brain. 99% is just, you know, taken out at different levels. And then the brain forms a subjective perception of the world based on our previous experiences, right? So without these experiences, we would not have a perception of the world, because think of it, your brain is in your skull and there are only small holes that sort of brings in the world, but still we feel that the world is complete in every second, but it's a subjective experience. So that's why the brain sort of don't really like ambiguity, because if it is ambiguity, it will create a pattern that is understandable. That's why I think it's so cool with your exhibition, Lisa, that it's very open for interpretation. That means that each and every one of us that will go down there and look at this exhibition will experience something different, because we will experience everything based on our previous experiences, but also on our current mood state, right? So if we are in a positive mood state or in a negative or in an ambiguous mood state, this will always affect our experience. And what's also cool is that if you go once to an exhibition like this, then you will experience it in one way. And then if you think about it again, every time you bring up a memory of something, as for example this exhibition, this will reform your memory. So memories are super unstable, right? And what's interesting there is, I think, because our self is based on our memories, right? So without memories, we have no self. But given that the memories are also unstable and changeable, so is our personality, right? And that's something that we think is so, you know, I know who I am, but we are constantly changing over time because our memories are changing, and this is changing also our experience of the world outside. So this is, you know, it's in a way difficult to really grasp this because it makes your agent, you know, feel so fragile, which it is.
Yes, and it's, you said it's hard to, what did you say? It's hard to imagine? It's hard to think about, grasp it, yeah. grasp. So that brings me to my mild preparation for this conversation, because I didn't want to just rely on what my memory or brain would offer tonight. You never know when it's going to be unreliable. Is the way that it's, because it's hard to grasp, we use metaphors. And that's why I was attracted to this, is because it's figuring a neurological dysfunction as a room or a series of rooms. And a series of rooms, have you noticed, that don't have doors? So then that adds another thing, like what does that mean? So there are different metaphors that have been recurring in your field in talking about the brain and or the mind. And one of them is architectural or through spaces. We think about the spatial nature of... I shouldn't follow the script. Let me just, get back. So there's the spatial, and then there's metaphors around art and literature. Cajal, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who's known as the father of neuroscience. Can you say that?
One of the
fathers of neuroscience, said that in terms of art, quote, if he is so determined, every man can be the sculptor of his own brain. And then in terms of building, like the word cement is used in a very verso called the neuralagia, which is the glial.
Glia cells.
Sorry, layperson talking neuroscience. The nerve cement, if you will, cement. So these kind of figurations of space, building, and then art and literature come up. And Cajal, this one of the fathers of neuroscience, was a big reader. His favorite book was Don Quixote. So literature came up in his imagination and how to discuss neurons and synapses. And then there's the metaphor of violence and love. And I want to go on to this quote that Cajal, that he said, and I'll read it out loud to you while it's up here. He imagined neurons as protagonists in an intense cerebral drama. Their fibers groped to find another. Their aching contacts became protoplasmic kisses, the final ecstasy in an epic love story. Okay, so there's love. And then I'm going to put that in relation to violence. But I'll get to that later through another thinker and another neurobiologist. But to stay with love a little bit, and Cajal, again, remember that he's one of the fathers of neuroscience. He's the one who took, on the right, on the right, you have an image of what was called the Black Reaction, which was founded by this guy Golgi, Camillo Golgi, an Italian scientist. And then on the left, what you have is a drawing by Cajal of neurons. If Cajal wanted to draw this loyally to the photograph, to what is actually there, it would not look like that, right? I don't know if you think so, but a lot of people think his drawings are absolutely beautiful. They've been the subject of exhibitions, art exhibitions as well included. And what he did was very interesting. He was a scientist. What he did, right? The search for objective knowledge in science. This is what his aim was. But what he did was he looked at his microscope and found these neurons and these synapses, or he couldn't see the synapses, extrapolated from them, but the neurons in a slice section of, let's say, a child's brain. And then he studied them very, very closely in his microscope and then went home and drew them by candlelight. And did this over and over and over again. And I would ask Håkan, like, why would you do that? Move away from an objective science, which the person who discovered the technology to make the photograph was this guy, Golgi, who's on the right-hand side. And as, just read those images. I'll let you read those images for a second and notice the differences between them. The one on the left is Cajal's. It's the scientist who made that beautiful drawing. You can kind of tell, right? And then the other one is this other person, Golgi. Can you talk about the difference between these two ways of looking at neurons and looking at the brain?
Yeah, no, I think that this is very interesting. You can think about the right-hand side images as the more objective images, whereas the left-hand side are much more the subjective images, the experience of what you have been noting or what's out there. And this is typically how the relation looks like between the outer world and the inner world, you know, I think. So he's both a scientist and an artist here in the same person, right? So
it's like if you and I had a baby.
Exactly. 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 So I think that in a way, or in many ways, I think that his sort of artistic interpretations of the objective world are much truer to sort of describe these phenomena than the actual pictures themselves, right? And that's why I think that art is so brilliant always, you know, that it can sort of help us to see things in reality that is not really there, obvious to anyone at any given time. And that might be, you know, from pictures or music or theater, whatever, right? So the subjective and the objective, I think that's what we see here. And consciousness and our experience is, again, sorry for repeating myself, but it's super subjective, right? This is important to pinpoint that just because it's brain and it's natural science, it's not objective in the sense that how it experiences the world. So I think that consciousness and how we look upon the world is very individual.
I could go on to like talk about, because your research is mainly done by, I mean, new technology, right? I mean, our current technology, which is MRI,
best,
or RMRI based. And it begs the question of like, are you making, are there other interpretive versions of MRI? Because when I look at MRI scans and the data, it's in terms of these two, it would be more like the one on the right, if you will. So where is the space of interpretation in the MRI? Maybe it's in language. And I can sort of hook that onto, again, oops, help, I don't have my glasses, so I can't see. I'm blind. Thank you. Right there. You can't have any talk around an art space or art without technical snafus. Just the way we roll. Okay, so back to this invocation of kisses and of love. It's very persistent in your field. I don't know if you've noticed, but they just published an article in Nature where they found this glutamatergic astrocytes. So a single astrocyte, this is in an article that was just published, a single astrocyte can participate in 2 million kisses, synapses between neurons. In those kisses, neurons send messages that contain glutamate, a molecule essential for human abstract thought. These astrocytes are concentrated in the brain regions involved in memory. And so this is the molecule that's not the neuron itself, right? We were talking about this. But it's integral. It's essential in memory, learning processes, in fear, in all of the superior emotions that a human being can have. And it's directly linked to Alzheimer's research right now It's apparently a big finding, but it's not the neuron itself. So the persistence of, I mean, these are two separate things, but the persistence of this figuration of kiss or the love, this is Cajal's working in the 1800s, it's all the way up to today that kiss or romance, the epic love story, is persistent. So within the realm of language, the way that we name brain functions and neuronal activity or mental function, can you talk about that a little bit, maybe?
Yeah. So I really like this metaphor with neurons kissing because neurons are really connecting with each other by means of these synapses, and that is like chemical substances that goes in between different neurons. It might be dopamine or serotonin or whatever, and it is really there that things are happening, right? You know, so if you take medicine or whatever, or if you feel love or whatever, this is where things really happen. So if it's very much positive things happening, then it's more dopamine, and if it's more negative things happening, then it's more serotonin and so on and so forth. But they are really kissing because it's also so that if you form a memory of something, and as I said before, the memories are the foundation of yourself, right? Then these neurons wire together. So if they fire together, they wire together, right? So and the more they fire together, the better they wire together. Then the memory becomes stable, right? So that's why then it's like a long kiss or whatever might call it.
It's so amazing.
And
do they break up?
They can definitely break up, and that is forgetting, right? When you forget something or change your perception or of your memory, which happens every time you re-remember something, then it's like a new memory being formed again. And if that memory changes a lot from the original memory, then there's no longer a kissing situation in between two neurons, but those neurons kiss other neurons, right, and form other connections. So it's constantly a network being reformed every minute that you sort of re-remember or re-experience that situation.
Yeah. Thank you. And that also ties into the interpretive qualities, like the interpretation as a function of the brain dealing with ambiguity. So that's a lot of kissing that happens, and maybe the same in certain areas. But if we have an information error where we don't have ambiguity, where we have so much information and there's little space for that, then a new subjectivity is formed because the brain is formed differently.
Yes.
Okay, so that's love. And that's through language, through Cajal's language of this epic love story, that he makes it novelistic, that he makes it literary, he makes it tragic and tender. Neurons, the brain. There's a philosopher named Catherine Malibu who she's a philosopher, but she takes into account neuroscience right now in her conception of and actually rethinking of different philosophical concepts and thinking about it politically. She works with this neurologist, Antonio Damasio. Yep. So she has another figuration for synapses that are coming together. She doesn't call them kisses, she calls them explosions. So right now I feel like I have a menu. Do I want the explosion or do I want the kiss? Do I want violence or do I want love? In conceiving of the way that my, that I'm speaking right now, that I am existing and aware of that. She says that, quote, I mean, we're constantly forming ourselves. And are we constantly forming ourselves through kisses or are we constantly forming ourselves through explosions? She says that if we didn't destroy ourselves a bit, we could not live. If we didn't destroy ourselves a bit, we could not live. Identity resists its own occurrence to the very extent that it forms it. So what it resists, again, in this interpretive space, in this destruction, as she calls it, in this explosion, destroying oneself, that's what forms us individually. So it's not a matter of if it's positive or negative, love or violence, that one figures it, both the negative and the positive, or whatever, the whole range in between, as kisses, and one forms it, formulates it in terms of explosions. The explosions almost has more of a resonance in my exhibition. I think, for those of you who haven't seen it, there's this video called Dodge and Burn, which revolves around trying to capture explosions, actually. It's on a 30-minute loop. It's 20 minutes long, so hopefully you have a chance to see it at some point. Yeah, just what do you make of these two figurations, these two ways of, these two words, really?
Yeah, no, it's interesting to think about this because from a neuroscientific standpoint, they are both correct, you know, in the sense that explosions are, you know, that I'm thinking that this neurotransmitter that sort of goes, you know, that travels in between neurons, they are sort of exploding in a sense that they are sort of released, and then they're captured by the other neuron, by its receptors. And this is, you know, so it will always be some kind of chemical explosion happening there, and that in turn form these kisses, right? So I see that these two concepts in a way as two sides of the same coin, but it depends on what you focus on really here. But as you say, the language makes a big difference in how we look upon this thing. And I would just also like to mention that language in general is so important for our conscious experience, you know. So it's thought that our conscious experience is developed by means of our language development, right? So, and this is true both throughout the life cycle, you know, from us being like a baby to a young kid and to a young adult to a grown up. Our vocabulary change from experience, but also from nature itself, and this will change also our consciousness. But what's also interesting here, I think, is that the culture that we are living in also change our language. I'm just thinking about love because I love, which is so interesting and nice, of course. That some cultures have like 50 words for love, whereas others have much fewer. And of course, it will be different for people growing up in that fifth world love culture compared to the other culture with fewer words in terms of experience love. And that's just one example. I'm just thinking about, you know, these Eskimos with all these names of snow, whatever. It's the same basic concept and thinking, right? That consciousness is formed by our culture, but also by our development in terms of language. So language is super central here, because a young child basically has, you know, two modes before language. Like it's like positive or negative, you know, basically. But then it sort of refines and refines and refines when language comes into play here. And this is how I'm thinking about language as being like a super strong factor in how we develop as humans. And that's also why I think that language should be, you know, at the heart of every person in a society, you know, and in schools and in everything, because it's so vital. We need to have language to really develop as human beings.
Great. We have 5 minutes left. Do you know what your colleague Mats, I forgot what his surname is, Mats and Anna from the
Mats
other...
Lekander.
Yes, Mats Lekander and Anna...
Andreasson.
So they're doing studies on the brain as well, but from burnout, right? Anna's really invested in burnout. What is the word? She was looking for another way to say chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
It was like horizon was in the word, so that it doesn't seem like it's permanent, but there could be an end to it. And it was completely inadequate in my mind. And we were thinking about, like, what is that? What should you phrase that? Mm. Because it's, again, like, and the way that burnout in this society, in terms of the social system, she says it's been an absolute disaster. Because it is an illness that, well, it's been designated as an illness, whereas other mental impairments have not. But, yeah, the prevalence of burnout, I don't know, she was just... Yeah. Anyway, so the status of language in this, maybe I'll take a total left turn and finish with the title of my exhibition, Dodge and or Burn. Do you know what Dodge and Burn is?
Yeah, I learned that from Teresa, who introduced us. You know, that's some kind of photo technique, you know, how you sort of work with the images after, you know, in the dark room. I've never done that myself, but it, you know, and also, it's a cool title, I think, you know.
Thanks. So, yeah, dodge and burn is a darkroom technique to either make an image lighter or darker, and I'm deeply interested in images and in language, but I think I was thinking about burnout and this chronic fatigue horizon or chronic fatigue syndrome because of the word burn, and the way I'm using dodge and burn is a double, at least double meaning, maybe even more than that, but dodge and burn is tied to making images lighter or darker and images, period, photography, but then also dodge as in dodge a bullet. That's, dodge. Quick movement, acceleration, quick. And burn, as in the world is burning, or heat, or fatigue, in the case of burnout. So maybe we can open it up to questions from the audience.
Thanks so much, Lisa and Håkan. I'm Wendela, I work here at the Accelerator. My question is about this space of interpretation that you've been coming back to, Lisa, and that we saw these wonderful examples of scientists going from making a scientific observation through a given technology like the microscope and then coming home and using some creative means to kind of make sense of that observation. My question is for you, Håkan, how do you come across this visuality, this visual means, or other sensory aesthetic means in your line of work? Because you interpret images all the time from your scans and other technologies. So that step between generating the data and then interpreting them, but also as an image. And that is so interesting, that creative space where you encounter the visualization in some form, and what you bring to that image. So as an artist, you have your own education and your own intentions, and you as a scientist come in with your intentions, and you're looking for particular information in the image. But do you ever draw, make or you know, use visual aesthetic forms as well as a way to kind of relate to these data that comes out of the machinery, basically. How do you, the visual culture kind of your field is, it's a very open question, but I'm very curious. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm not really working so much myself with images and so, but I'm I think that I try to sort of use other other ways of of art to sort of come across and understand the work that I'm doing, but also the situation, you know, in life in general, because I'm playing in a rock band and we are sort of constantly sort of working on understanding the world by means of our music, just by playing. And so I think I'm more like a sound person than a picture person, but I can really see the beauty and the details in the MR images as a beautiful piece of art, especially when you do statistics on it, because then you will have these really nice color shapes that you can sort of manipulate also by means of statistics, so that the image becomes more than just an objective image of the brain, but also a sort of statistical interpretation of the activation that we are after, right? If we're after anxiety or memory function or whatever. So I think that this is one way of, you know, that we are working with the images and the data. We are sort of trying to make sense of these colors, where redder colors are higher numbers and blue colors are lower numbers. Then you can also look at structure in the brain that are so beautiful. I don't know if you've seen these images with all these networks in different colors, and all the different networks are colored differently, and this is like objective in the sense that it's, you know, maths, but at the same time it's so beautiful. So you cannot do anything sometimes but just to look at this, and do not do anything but just feel that this is amazing. So I do not do so much work with pictures, you know, in other sense that sort of I do stats and I admire them, but then I do music and I try to sort of interpretate my situation in a way. I don't know if that's an answer.
Do you call it a rock band? I would call it like emo synth. Emo synth rock.
I would like to just hook on to Vendela's question and your answer, Håkan. I'm interested to know more about where this image that you see, you describe it as like beautiful and intriguing, but at one point, is it insufficient? What do you miss out? Or do you miss out on aspects if you're like completely relying on this image? I think I'm after what aspects of a condition that you might not see, or that could perhaps be tricked of by just relying on that image. I don't know. I guess it's it's a guess. And then if Lisa, if you could just also hook on and to this question of the role of imaging or images, as I know that, for example, in the video work Dodge and Burn, and in several of your video works, you're kind of avoid many images or filmed images, or sometimes let perhaps graphic images or text speak for a photographic image instead of showing that image.
Okay, I can just start by saying that. In terms of if you miss out things in images, like in brain images from MR or whatever, like PET or whatever. Yes, of course, because the image reflects what you ask the image, right? So your questions to the image, and then you look upon the image in that sense, you know. And now I'm thinking about statistics here, or, you know, that way of of working with the data. So if you ask one thing, then it will get one type of picture, and if you have something else, then it will get another type of picture. So the experience objectivity in the image, from this, you know, nice colors and the brain and etc. It's very subjective because it depends on what I choose to show, right? So that's how it is.
As a young artist, I was influenced by Felix Gonzalez-Torres and his work, and he taught me something really important, which was image versus text. It's just very, very simple, like what one does without the other, or what one, and vice versa. You can see one of his Dateline paintings, or Dateline works right now at the Modern Museum in this Rashid Johnson show, and it's dates that run across, dates and events, events and their dates that run across the very, very top of the space, like a super title, if you will. So if I say, I don't know, what's an important date in your life? I don't know, birth, you know, whatever your year is, birth, or Lincoln was assassinated in that year, or more currently, Black Lives Matter, this date, June 2020, COVID, et cetera, et cetera. We will all come to it with our own associations and our own image bank. Early on, I made a film that was quite pretentious. It was called One Night Stand Paris. And I went to Paris for one night. I was working a day job in New York where I used to live, I moved to Stockholm. And I was working in an architecture firm, burning the candle at both ends, and I desperately wanted to make art, but I only had my weekends to make art. So I decided I'm going to maximize that time. I saved my money and bought a trip to Paris to go for one night, walk around past midnight without a camera, thinking about Eugène Ajay and all of the pictures, Bresson, all of these pictures of Paris that we have, even if we haven't been there. Felix Gonzalez-Torres said that it was part of his blood memory. The first time that he went there, he had already been there because it was part of his blood memory, and I think because it circulated through the realm of images and literature and Gertrude Stein, who he was in love with. And I went there and walked around at night and only recorded what I saw, really jet-lagged, again, coming from New York, and just what I saw. You see a lot of pharmacy signs. That's what I saw. Like blinking, you know, neon lights. Which then recalls, like, yeah, other thinkers and other thought traditions. But, and then I took what was in that notebook in a very Warholian way, just transcribed that notebook and put it against a black background. So it's just subtitles from that notebook. It's completely imageless. And I hadn't thought about that until now, you thinking about it, but or you mentioning Dodge and Burn downstairs, which really only has one, two, maybe three actual moving images that were shot in camera. And the rest is either black, white, or a word, or a graphic. So it is, because I want you, because there's a dominant voiceover also, which is my voice in the video, but I know that you will have your own images. I can rely on that. They won't be mine, and that's great. They won't be mine, they'll be yours. And that's the mechanism that I'm tacking onto with refusing images, so that you actually draw from them. Right. Is it here or here?
Yeah. Image is here.
Okay, image is here. Image is back here. See, we're learning something. Any more questions to be in front of a human biological psychologist?
I have a question on, like, in the end when you were talking about burnout and the 50 words for love. Like, is there a possibility, or is there like a risk for overload in the brain and in the synapses? Is that like related to both burnout, but also like the risk for overload? Is that like also contrasted with an easy way between the synapses, if that makes sense. Because I've been thinking a lot about like polarization and like if that is related to polarization, that like there's an easy way chemically in the brain that we want to like associate and like create meaning and understand our surrounding world. So yeah, my thought and your thought on it.
Okay, thank you for that question. So I don't think really that there is a risk of overload in the brain in the sense that there's like too many active neurons here or there or too much synapses or whatever, because the brain works as a system, right? So the entire brain sort of regulates itself, which means that the frontal part of the brain is very vital in control functions, right? So the frontal brain, it controls emotions, it controls memories, cognitive functions, and so on and so forth, which means that these control functions, they can both down and up regulate your experiences of your daily work or whatever you have been involved in, a trauma situation or whatever. Then these are sort of, this is really the gas and the brake of all of everything else that is happening in the brain. So there are no like local overloads in that sense, but it's more that frontal cortex might not function in a way that is optimal for that person, which means that you cannot really control your experiences of a situation, and then you will feel stressed, and stress is poisonous for your brain, right? So stress kills neurons, especially in the hippocampus, which means that you get poorer and poorer memory, so sort of learning new memories, which means that yourself will be sort of weaker and weaker over time if you are very stressed, which means that you have perfect memories of your past, but no memories of the current situation, and you will have very vague memories of your upcoming time, which is very, very problematic. So in that sense, it's maybe not like an overload, but rather like a killing situation in vital regions like the hippocampus, which will reform your self and also your experience of your social situation, as for example. I don't know if that was an answer, but...
Thank you. It's been really fascinating listening to you both. I was thinking about this connection you guys both talked about language, and Håkan spoke about social construct. And then there's this whole idea of kahal and the idea of the kiss. And I was just wondering whether you think that Cahal would have romanticized his portrayal of what's happening in the same way if he was working today in a what I would call sort of a modern Western social construct.
I don't know, of course, but I would say that that's the reason why Catherine Malibu uses explosions. Is she also has a political objective in her something at stake in contemporary consciousness and political consciousness. So she wants to invoke violence. She wants to talk about the danger of losing the ability to be affected. That can happen with disease like Alzheimer's. But if we lose the ability to be affected and we're apathetic and we have less of these kisses, if you will, then she worries, right? So her use of language, I think, with explosions, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but as a reader, that's the way that I interpret that use and that, image of violence.
Okay, I think we'll stop there. Thank you so, so much, Håkan and Lisa, for this very inspiring and thoughtful conversation. Thank you so much, and thank you to you that have joined us tonight. And don't miss the exhibition if you haven't seen it. Thank you.